just wanted to start by acknowledging Michael as well, because what a fantastic job he's done with John Stanley James and making sure that John Stanley James journalism is known. It's just a terrific project, and I'm very honoured to have been included in this, so thank you. I will give you a little bit of a background because Michael's not officially speaking tonight. I'll start by giving a little bit of background on The Vagabond. I'm sure many of you already know. But when he arrived in Australia, the first Australians knew about him was that in the mid-1870s, in the Argus, anonymous reports of life in colonial Melbourne started to surface, written by somebody under the nom de plume of a vagabond. So The Vagabond, and this is where I got interested, because The Vagabond went undercover to write these stories and wrote these long, immersive, beautifully crafted narratives. He worked as an inmate or lowly employee in these institutions, writing exposés, and they were the colony's harshest institutions. Pentridge Jail, where he spent a month, the Immigrants' Home, the Alfred Hospital, the Benevolent Asylum and the Lunatic Asylums. And that's a very unusual thing to do that early. In terms of journalism history, that was a very early instance of undercover journalism. So at that time, as you would all know better than I would, industrialisation had created this underclass of urban poor, and The Vagabond wrote about the everyday experiences of people who were the poorest and least powerful members of Melbourne society. It was an instant hit with the paper's readership. That's one of the illustrations that accompanied, I took that from Michael's book. The stories were factual, lengthy, and they betrayed an empathy with the subject matter that was in contrast to the sort of journalism that was being done about the urban poor in America and England. It wasn't sensationalist, it wasn't written for the entertainment of people of a higher class in society, or to allay or to exaggerate the fears of people concerned about industrialisation. He wrote about these people from their point of view. These articles stirred passions, excuse me, they changed opinions, and they prompted more than one public inquiry. And as Michael shows in his book, some of the questions asked at three of these inquiries were elderly inmates of the Benevolent Asylum, purposely starved to death in a primitive form of euthanasia. Yes, turns out they were. Were the bodies of pauper children thrown into a common grave at the Melbourne General Cemetery and interred without benefit of the clergy? Yes, they were. Did a well-known doctor perform lithotomy operations with his penknife? Well, no, he just boasted about it, so not that one. So just stepping back a bit to continue this introduction, John Stanley James was born on the 15th of November 1843 in Wolverhampton, Staffordshire. He was the only son of a respectable, although cold-hearted, solicitor. At the age of 12, James ran away from his English boarding school in what proved a defining experience at the cusp of adolescence. Excuse me. And I'm mentioning this one because I want you to see the approach that he took in terms of his refusal to bow to authority. And Michael's done a fantastic job tracing where that comes from. This is in The Vagabond's own words. Fagging and bullying were then much in vogue, and I suffered from both. I fought the cock of the school for an hour until I was in a far worse condition than many a pugilist after a prize fight. The only result was that I was severely punished by the headmaster. Then my soul grew hard within me, and I only thought of vengeance. In a short time, I was again called on to fag by my tormentor. I refused, and the bully persuasively twisted my arm. After he had tortured me for a few minutes, he let me go, and then, flying to primal man's first means of offence, everywhere provided by nature, I seized a sharp stone. The missile struck my antagonist fair on the temple. I was seized and taken before the masters and then locked up in my room. For 2 days I remained there, fed on bread and water. The headmaster once visited me and in a severe lecture intimated that X would die and I should be hanged. At least if he did recover, I most likely would be handed over to the police and endure public ignominy. I hardened my heart, the sense of the injustice of things in this world, which the very young perhaps alone feel, made me defiant. What did I care if my tormentor died? Care, I hoped he would die. So on the third night, I dropped from the window by the aid of the sheets, and before morning was in a large town 15 miles off. And when, 3 days after my absconding, I read a handbill describing my appearance and offering £100 reward for my recovery, I looked on this as an endeavour to capture a criminal and not as the frightened efforts of the headmaster to undo his foolish work. For long months, he thought I had drowned myself, and the school suffered considerably through the scandal. That, I think, was the birth of the vagabond. He began to tramp across England, sleeping in villages, market towns and cities, frequenting threepenny and sixpenny lodging houses used by hawkers, vagrants and beggars. As Michael says in his book, in the indiscriminate mixture of humanity in the dormitories, he found much that was disgusting, but he remembered the rough comradeship of the men with an affection that was its own bitter commentary on the icy nature of his home. I won't fill you in much more about his youth, though it's absolutely fascinating. I suggest you read Michael's introduction because I do want to get on to New Caledonia. He ended up in London. He ended up freelancing as a journalist for a while. Life began to get a bit comfortable, and he took himself off to Paris in 1870. And at that time, of course, political tensions were at breaking point in Paris. It was the eve of the siege of Paris by the Prussians in the Franco-German War, and it was also the end of the Second French Empire. And there'd been this continued call for a democratic republic, on top of which there was food rationing and unemployment and sheer fear in the face of the advancing Prussian army. Within a few months, the rebellions would escalate into the establishment of the short-lived Paris Commune. The English were hungry for news of the riots across the Channel, so that's how the vagabond ended up in Paris, because he was going to freelance from there. But within 48 hours of landing in Paris, James found himself on the wrong side of the authorities. He was imprisoned as a spy for 6 weeks until released on representations of the British Embassy because of his sympathy with the French secessionists, the party that had been plotting to depose Napoleon III, and his acquaintance with one of the leading insurrectionists, Gustave Flourens. I think that's how you pronounce it. He said in one of his papers, "In my callow days I was a rebel, and from Garibaldians to Fenians I have ever since had a sneaking fondness for those in arms against constituted authority." So he was a rebel. He of course then went to America when he was about 30. He dropped his family name and sailed to America, where he disembarked as Julian Thomas, ready to begin afresh, and kept the same name, Julian Thomas, when he came to Australia. I'm not going to touch on America because we have Bob here. After the vagabond couldn't stay undercover in Melbourne for much longer than a year. His identity was exposed eventually. His managing editor at the Argus, manager at the Argus came to Sydney to work on the Sydney Morning Herald, and he followed him to the Herald. And he tried to write similar undercover pieces about life in Sydney, the urban poor in Sydney, but they weren't nearly as successful. And he was given this job of going to New Caledonia to report on the Great Rebellion in 1878, the Great Revolt. Of course, in 1853, New Caledonia had been annexed by the French, and in 1863, it had become a penal colony. Excuse me. 16,000 convicts, 4,500 of them were communards deported to the Île de Pin. And there was an influx of settlers from the 1860s after the discovery of nickel and other precious metals, which resulted in a land grab on the main island. Just to give you a sense of what that land grab meant, in 1862, 27,000 hectares had been taken, and in 1877, 150,000 hectares were taken in that year. The Kanaks were treated very badly in all of this. They were forced out of the best farming lands. They were forced up into the mountains where it was much less habitable. And in 1878, the French wanted to take a large area of land around the village of Lafoy. I think that's how you pronounce it, sorry. And this was an area that was controlled by the chief Attai, and it affected villages that were his responsibility. And so he led this revolt that lasted for a year. It was a year-long war in which, and I think these figures are fairly conservative, 200 settlers and 1,000 Kanaks died. So the Sydney Morning Herald, Hugh George, sent James to New Caledonia to report on it, and he was to be embedded with the French colonial forces. And the reason he was sent was because the stories that were coming in from New Caledonia to Sydney, arriving in Sydney, were based on second-hand information. They weren't eyewitness reports. They were short. They tended to be short, cobbled together pieces, pulled together into one narrative. They were in the clipped language of news that had started to come in after the introduction of the telegraph, where stories were sent by one finger typing down a line. The vagabond had already shown, James had already shown, he was the perfect choice for this assignment. He spoke French. He was a fabulous writer. He wrote compelling observational stories. He was popular with readers. He clearly wasn't going to automatically take the line of the French authorities. The stories that were coming in, these second-hand pieces, never questioned what the French were doing. And he was an adventurer. If anybody could cope in New Caledonia in a war, it would be him. So he was sent, and he was went off with his papers of introduction, and he was what we would now call embedded. Of course, they didn't use that term then. With Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vendling, the commander of the French forces, who kept him busy marching up and down hillsides so he couldn't send anything. All the dispatches that were coming in from Sydney with information that would have helped him write or report on New Caledonia never reached him. And the stuff that he was writing never got back to Sydney. In fact, it wasn't until he went back to Sydney later that he rewrote them and had them published. He eventually left and made his own way to Lafoy, and Commandant Henri Riviere, who was the person in charge in that area. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about this particular piece from New Caledonia that he wrote, because my interest is in the journalism, and my interest is in what an extraordinary figure he was in the history of Australian journalism, and what the new ways of writing that he brought here, that he invented here. And I'm interested in the context for that. So despite his sympathy for the underdog, he displayed all the coarse bigotry of his day. He often included these asides in his articles about niggers and Jews and Chinese in the most awful ways, you know, which would have been typical of the time. And clearly, nobody complained. It landed perfectly well with his audiences. And what was amazing about his reports from New Caledonia is that he increasingly expresses sympathy for the Kanaks. That's just a picture I found on the net that's from 1870. Anyway, the particular piece I'd like to talk about was where he covered the execution of 5 Kanaks, including a 13-year-old boy. And the executions were in retaliation for the killing of an ex-convict called Priere, an employee of a French settler. Now, nobody was behaving kindly and well in this place, you know, at this time. It was tough. Life was tough, and these people had survived terrible ordeals. And they were grabbing land because it was a new opportunity for them. So the day before Briere's murder, a pig belonging to the settler who employed him had been speared. And in retaliation, the settler's men had fired on a group of natives, killing 2, a man and a woman. And it appeared Briere's death was in revenge for the native deaths. Now, what was interesting about the vagabond is that his journalism, his work, his experience as a journalist kicked in. He tells you in this story the process of his investigation of the facts. His first thought was that the Kanaks had been framed. Now, that's an extraordinary thought, really, for a colonial settler himself. He was a colonial settler in Australia. where very similar things were happening with First Nation people here. It turned out that no, the Kanaks hadn't been framed. They had done this killing. Then he wondered, had Briere invited it, because Briere was well known to be a very cruel, ruthless person. He then attempted to visit Batiste, a Kanak chief, for more information. Again, an extraordinary step in those times. A messenger arrived in the camp who claimed he'd been attacked by natives on his journey, and John Stanley James interviewed him and didn't believe a word of it. But unfortunately, Riviere did. And Riviere rounded up these five Kanaks who had already been prisoned for a month without trial. They most likely had nothing to do with the killing of Briere. And he ordered them to be marched to the place of Briere's death to be shot and their bodies burnt as a warning to other people, to their compatriots. And James writes in his coverage, it ordained an act illogical, unjust, and useless in its results. One of the interesting things about this article is it's factual. One of the things we know about John Stanley James is that while he wrote creatively, he used scenes, he included dialogue, he used all the techniques of imaginative literature, he didn't make up the facts. No one ever could find fault with the actual facts of his stories. And he took that very seriously. Yet he wrote from a strong point of view. The stories do have a point of view. And that's an aspect of journalism I think we sometimes lose to our, sadly. Okay, I'll read you a bit from it. Four were handcuffed in pairs and they were all joined by a stout rope. The last was a boy of only 13. The others of ages ranging from 25 to 40. All were quite naked except one, who had still the striped jersey worn by the boatman of the port. Round his neck, the boy had a small key suspended by a piece of string. I wondered whether he had ever possessed a box or only wore it as an ornament. Another wore a garter adorned with shells, another had a string of beads around his neck. Their woolly hair had been dyed red by lime, some rude combs were stuck therein. Note the detail that allows that scene to come to life. I've underlined some bits here. They were splendid specimens of humanity, not large men, but with beautifully formed limbs. Two had broad noses and thick lips, but two had almost European features, one being very handsome, with fine eyes which fixed themselves on mine inquiringly. He seemed to seek a friend, and it might be that he saw the sympathy which was in my soul. In colour, these men were light brown. In each, the brain was well developed. They were of a race far superior to the Australian savage. Now, James Spurr in The Rhetoric of Empire wrote, under Western eyes, the body is that which is most proper to the primitive. And note how James wrote about the bodies. That was what he was doing. He started that article by writing about the Kanak's bodies, the sign by which the primitive is represented. The bodies not only of so-called primitive peoples, but of all the colonised, have been a focal point of colonialist interest, which proceeds from the visual to various kinds of valorisation. The material value of the body as labour supply, its aesthetic value as object of artistic representation, its ethical value as a mark of innocence or degradation, its scientific value as evidence of racial difference or inferiority, its humanitarian value as the sign of suffering, its erotic value as the object of desire. And if we just go back, you can see he talks almost scientifically about the brain being well developed. He talks about their inferiority to the Australian the Australian Aborigines' inferiority to them. He talks about the aesthetic value of them physically. James goes on, and one of the things that I think is really interesting about that is that that's probably the only way he could connect with his readers. It was probably a natural way for him to approach describing these people, but it's also how his audience would have been able to hear. That's what they're looking for, some way of connecting into what he's trying to say. So James goes on to describe the long trek, making it clear his conscience is aroused and that the readers should be too. For 6 miles we toiled through the blazing sun. It was hard work and it seemed to me cruel to drag those poor wretches out thus far to kill them. I watched them curiously as we marched along. I wished that the young savage with the handsome face and the fine eyes would not look at me with those glances of intelligence. To my dying day, they will haunt me. Our prisoners were told to sit down. Did they know what they were brought hither for? The boy had broken off a small branch of the gnarly tree and was beating off the mosquitoes from himself and his next neighbour. The rest talked in low tones. What were we waiting for? In a few minutes there was a call to attention. Down the path from the other side, a body of men marched. James continues to describe the scene, gradually allowing more of his personal observations to intrude and gradually drawing the reader's attention to the injustice he felt he was witnessing. The orders were given clearly and quietly. There were five trees in line. To these they were bound. The boy was first uncoupled and taken to the tree, his hands tied behind him and a bandage placed round his eyes. Then the others must have known the fate in store for them, but they did not wince or take any notice. One by one, the process was repeated, the surveillant and a convict who appeared to take brutal delight in the work officiating. There was not the slightest resistance or murmur from the prisoners. The last was my handsome friend. Released from his fellow, he remained for a couple of minutes perfectly free and unshackled and again looked at me with those wistful eyes. Why did he not make one effort for life and freedom? If he had started, I would have bet that in the bush none of our rifles could hit him. I almost felt mad with the man, and my lips found words which he would not understand. Faisi, cried the surveillant. The Kanak was looking at me. Sacre nom de Dieu, said the man, rushing forward, seizing the prisoner's wrist and giving him a torrent of abuse for not being in a hurry to go to be killed. Monsieur Vanneau gave the order. 20 men were told off, 6 to each prisoner. At 5 paces, these took aim, and at the words make ready, the chassepots and minis were levelled, the liers who were in the firing party being quite eager for the signal. And the victims against the trees? 4 stood up erect, with chests inflated, and every nerve and muscle strung, ready to die like warriors. The boy alone had his head sunk on his breast. The word was given, a discharge, and 3 bodies slid softly to the ground. The doctor to the ground, shouted Monsieur Vanneau. I accompanied him. The other 2 bodies sank down. There was not a word nor a groan. The coup de grace was given to 3 who had yet lived by the revolver of the surveillant. Lombriere and the pigs of Boya were avenged. Blood for blood. So it's a remarkable piece of writing. James creates empathy rather than pity for the Kanaks. And he's done that because he's drawing the reader, and not just the reader, but the Kanaks themselves into the scene. They're not just passive people in this scene. Despite their silence, despite the impossibility of communication across those cultural and power barriers, they are active in this scene. He gives them a humanity equal to his own. And that is the trademark of his journalism, really, in everything he writes. So, remarkable stuff. So where he begins the story treating the Kanaks as objects to be viewed with curiosity and with a mind only to their value, he finishes by repatriating them to the status of human beings. And he demonstrates that his first duty as a journalist, which, you know, is a remarkable lesson still for, you know, at least my students, is that the first duty is to the truth-telling rather than to the line the hosts wanted him to spin or even to his European heritage. And I think it's a fascinating thing that by taking that slow approach, you know, slow, everything's very fashionable these days, but that slow approach to journalism of sitting down and doing that job properly results in breaking down barriers. His last line is, let us be just, they perished like heroes and I drink to the dead. Well, I'm not sure it's the last line of the piece, but, you know, he's drinking to them as warriors. And Henri Rivière, of course, was not happy. That caused a great fuss when these were eventually published in Sydney. But as Michael points out, they were very influential. His writings from New Caledonia were very influential in changing New South Wales' attitudes to the French in New Caledonia.